This is Line Break, where we deconstruct poetry written by young writers and discuss the inspiration and intention behind their poems. Take a pause and enjoy the line breaks. This is part 2 of episode 20 with just me, Iris, also known as Eyes of Iris, and I hope you enjoy. Hi everyone, it's Iris, also known as Eyes of Iris on Young Writers Project. And after making 20 episodes of Line Break, I got to think more about what Line Break is. And at its core, Line Break is a celebration of writing and creativity. And this episode will be a reflection of that as I take a closer look at the words and worlds that have shaped me as a writer and human being. I also thought this would be a nice chance for you all to learn more about me and my writing in this episode that is just me. So, let's get into it. I read a lot, both volume-wise and genre-wise. I actually don't read as much poetry as I used to, but there are definitely still poems and poets that I return to read poems that I had read years ago and wanted to look back at again, or to see if poets had new poems that I hadn't discovered yet. And back when I first started writing poetry, I tried to read as much as possible so I could figure out the secrets to writing a good poem. And of course, I didn't find the secrets, because there aren't any. But I did find inspiration, and over time, by reading and rereading poetry, I began to figure out what my writing style was, and I found that I liked certain ways of writing and didn't like other ways. I think it was a real exploration of words and writing and how I wanted those to appear in my mind and in the pages of my notebook. So I found an anthology of poetry at a little free library, which are so cool. Definitely check them out. They're like these little standalone libraries with maybe a dozen books. Sometimes you can find them in neighborhoods, in parks, just on the side of the road, at least in Vermont. I'm not sure about other places, but there are tons around the Burlington area that you should check out. And I found an anthology of poetry from the Poetry Foundation, and I went through each poem and circled or underlined the phrases that I liked. Sometimes I liked the entire poem, and sometimes I just liked one line or even just one word. And I really liked the freedom of this, of feeling like I could just go through and I didn't have to like everything, you know? I could just like what stuck to me and what like really spoke to me as a writer and as a reader. Yeah, it was really great to not feel like I had to just love it, you know? Sometimes when you read a poem in a class, you feel like I have to like this because the instructor is hyping it up, you know? They're making it seem like it's so cool and it's so amazing. And sometimes it just doesn't speak to you as much as, you know, just one line or one part of it. So I really enjoyed reading E.E. Cummings' poetry around the time that I first started getting into poetry, which was about 3 or 4 years ago, back in like 7th, 8th grade. And I think that his poems really showed me how I could experiment with form and the visual aspect of my poem. For example, where I placed the words on the page and capitalization and grammar and all that. And I read a lot of the classics, like Langston Hughes and Emily Dickinson and Shakespeare. And I also discovered some modern poets who have really inspired me. And on YouTube, there's a channel called Button Poetry, where poets read their work. And I think they have maybe 20 different poets, sometimes more. And it's a really great way to find new poets or poems to be inspired by. Actually, one of my favorite poets who's featured on there a lot is Sarah Kay. She's so amazing. I love her poems. And she reads them, and there's usually a live audience. I don't know if they've been doing that recently, of course, but from a few months ago, at least they'd have live audiences, and it was just so cool. It was like you were there at a real live open mic. Now I want to read a little something for you, and this is a poem that I found fairly recently, but I've returned to it again and again and found a different meaning every time, really, which is what's so magical to me about writing, is how, like, every time you go back to a poem or a book or something, you can find something different about it, you know? You find a new meaning that suits you every time that your life, you know, evolves and changes. This is On This, the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, we reconsider the buoyancy of the human heart by Laura Lamb Brown Lavoie. Hope you enjoy. What's wrong? Titanic asked me this morning when she found me lying on the ocean floor with all my suitcases strewn open. Oh, I don't know, I moaned. I was looking through National Geographic and saw some pictures of you and thought I might come and chat. You look great, by the way, in the pictures. Me? No. Titanic smiled. If anything, I seem to have become a Picasso and I have a beard. It was true. She looked more like a collage of a ship, strangely two-dimensional and a crater of her own making. French doors, boilers, railings every which way, and she did have a bit of a beard, rust icicles hanging in red strands from her iron engines. Sitting up in my own little crater, I sort of blushed. To be honest, I told Titanic, my honey's leaving town soon, and I'm afraid it's going to wreck me, so I dove down here. Well, come on in, Titanic said, but I'm not sure I've got what you're looking for. So in I climbed through a window between two rust stalactites and began to pace her great promenade, which would have been awesome, by the way, walking by the ghosts of all those waving handkerchiefs, except I was in that feeling sorry for yourself state where every hallway is the hallway of your own wretched mind, every ghost your own ghost, so I didn't take a good look around. When I got to the Turkish baths, I sat on the edge of a barnacled tub and watched weird crabs scrabble at my feet. I was hoping you'd teach me how to sink, I said. You, who have spent a century underwater with 1,500 skeletons in your chest. I don't know, said Titanic. I'm kind of a wreck. Exactly, I said. Me too. I'm here to apprentice myself to wreckage. I'm here to apprentice myself to you. Great bearded lady, gargantuan arc, you floating hotel, with enough ballrooms in you to dance with everyone I've ever loved. My heart has an iceberg with its name on it, I told Titanic, so I need some advice. Tell me, did you see the iceberg coming? I did, Titanic said. And you sailed right into it? It was love, Titanic said. And the band just kept playing, and the captain stayed at the wheel? What did it feel like to swallow seawater? Tell me, Titanic, how did it feel? It felt like a hole in my side, and then it felt like plummeting face first into the ice-cold ocean. She's a straight talker, the Titanic. All right, I said. Now let's talk about rest. When my love leaves, I'm planning to weep stalactites from my chin. I will wear my sadness in long strands. Like you, I will be bearded by it. Then I made a terrible noise. Eek! I've been practicing the sound of wrenching metal, I told her, for when my love leaves. But you aren't made of metal, Titanic said to me. I'm a writer, I said. I could be made of anything. Well then, be a writer, she said. Be a writer? I paused, anemones between my toes. Okay. When my love leaves, I'll start with SOS. I will Morse code odes as a whole world goes vertical. I'll write nosedives as my torso splits in two. And the next day, I'll write the stunt headlines. And the next day, I'll write the obituaries. And the next day, I will write furious accusations. And the next day, I will write lawsuits. And the next day, I will write confessions of my wrongdoing. And the next day, I will write pardons, but I won't really mean it. And the next day, I'll write sonnets, but they won't fit the schema. And the next day, I'll write, please, please, please come back. The next day, I will write epitaphs, navigation maps, warning for future generations about the hubris of human love. I will write quotas and queries and quizzes. I will write nonsense. I will write nonsense. I will write nonsense all the way down, and no diving teams will find me. No robot arms will retrieve me in pieces. Never will I be reassembled and played again. No, I will remain whole. 2 miles down, with my suitcases strewn open, and in 100 years, I will still be writing about this feeling, though my heart be Picasso, though my heart be bearded at the bottom of the sea. The Titanic let me cry for a while, my sobs echoing off her moldy mosaics. Then she said, girl, you're too young for a beard like this. You're never going to get some if you rust over now. I sniffled a little and scratched my name into the green slime of the tub. The trouble with you humans is that you're so concerned with staying afloat. Go ahead, be gouged open by love. Gulp that salt water, sink beneath the waves. You're not a boat, you can go under and come up again, with those big old lungs of yours, those hard-kicking legs. And your heart, she said, that gargantuan arc, that floating hotel, call it unsinkable, though it is sinkable. Embark, embark. There are enough ballrooms in you to dance with everyone you'll ever love. That's what the Titanic told me this morning, me, lying next to her on the ocean floor. There are enough ballrooms in you. I hope you all enjoyed that. And I love this poem so much. Depending on how my life has shifted since the last time I read it, I find another phrase that I didn't notice before. I take a new perspective on the poem. Even as I was reading it just now, I noticed things that I hadn't noticed before. And the language is so beautiful. The whole concept is just amazing. And the little phrases, like when the narrator asks the Titanic how to sink, and the Titanic says, I don't know, I'm kind of a wreck. I just love how the author has written this poem. I also love the final line, there are enough ballrooms in you, which affects me differently every time I read it. And amongst all the grief that the narrator feels, all this like kind of anger and sadness, here's a giant monster of a ship telling her that she's enough. There are enough ballrooms in her. She has enough space and time to figure it all out. and it's just beautiful. So this is a common theme I'm going to be talking about. And what draws me to certain poems is that one line or phrase or idea that comes to me days after I've read it. If there's still a little part of a piece that's hanging around in my mind with no intent to leave, then I know that it's a good poem. If, on the other hand, I read a poem and can't really take anything from it, I don't remember anything from it, then I don't like it as much. And that doesn't mean that it's a good poem, but it doesn't really have a lasting effect, and that's kind of what I look for when I read poems. So, here's another one I'm going to read to you. Actually, I don't think I mentioned it yet, but I'm going to be reading several poems and excerpts and things from books and such that have inspired me. So these are like the books and poems and words that have inspired me, and I want to share them with all of you so that you know what I love and what has just stuck around in my mind for a while. So this next poem is from a collection of poetry that I actually won at a Young Writers Project raffle a few years ago. It was at a conference in Montpelier back at VCFA, if you guys remember that. And this is by Karen Gottschall. And I was really inspired by this poem and actually wrote one of my own that's based on the idea that this poem has of why the narrator did what they did, which is, you know, this action is never really mentioned, but there are all these really beautifully written reasons. So this is why I did it. Because dusk had a habit of falling before I'd finished putting on my mascara. Because you can't read by the light of an onion, and I'd never seen my name written in calligraphy. Because I was so lonely, I talked to the radiators. Because home was a series of broken Mr. Coffees, and the cotton hems of my nightgowns had all frayed. Because once there was a fair maiden who rode the bus to her job at the supermarket. Because of the canned peaches, and the fire. Because I've never held a full pitcher without my wrist shaking. Never broken a bone. Because a loose thread came teasing its way from the sleeve of my blouse, and I couldn't stop pulling. Because I was thusly unsleeved. Because there was once a goose girl who was only a goose girl. Because someone's sister turned a corner and died. Because someone else's sister never called. Because I was unconvinced by commercials asserting my inalienable right to loveliness. Beauty like smooth milk. Because the snow came early that year, and I lay in my bed at dawn worrying about every single word I'd ever said. Because I said no. Said yes. Because the sky was a vintage film strip reel, and the concrete smelled like driving too slowly, like the fear of death. Because the only ticket I could afford was to a city where no one knew me, and I never wanted to go. Because I was pretty sure I'd eventually go there anyway. Now, I really just love this poem because of, like, all the reasons, and they're so varied, and it just really gives you a good look into the narrator's mind and like how they view the world and their life without really saying that much about their life. So another poem, and this is definitely not the last of my favorites. I could go on and on and on for years about words and poems that I love. This is by Billy Collins, and it's inspired by one of my own poems that's in the September issue of The Voice and YWP, titled Billy Collins. Now, this is his poem, You Reader, and it's the first of his poems that I ever read, and it spoke to me on so many levels. So, You Reader. I wonder how you are going to feel when you find out that I wrote this instead of you. That it was I who got up early to sit in the kitchen and mention with a pen the rain-soaked windows, the ivy wallpaper, and the goldfish circling in its bowl. Go ahead and turn aside, bite your lip and tear out the page, but listen. It was just a matter of time before one of us happened to notice the unlit candles and the clock humming on the wall. Plus, nothing happened that morning. A song on the radio, a car whistling along the road outside, and I was only thinking about the shakers of salt and pepper that were standing side by side on a placemat. I wondered if they had become friends after all these years, or if they were still strangers to one another like you and I, who managed to be known and unknown to each other at the same time. Me at this table with a bowl of pears, you leaning in a doorway somewhere near some blue hydrangeas, reading this. So, what drew me to this poem is the conversational tone of the narrator and just the reminiscence. And another thing that's so interesting to me is that I feel like in this poem, you could be the writer or you could be the reader, you know? You could be the person who's writing about this other person, or you could be the person who someone else is writing about you. Oh gosh, that doesn't make sense. Or you could be the person that someone else is writing about. You know, the roles change depending on how and when in your life you read this poem. And there's so many lines in here that really stick out to me and that I remember days after reading it, which is a really good example of the lasting effect that I was just talking about, is how I remember certain lines, like about the blue hydrangeas and the bowl of pears and, you know, the car going by in the road, and certain things just pop in my head after I read it. And I think that my poem explains how much this means to me a lot better. So this is my poem, Billy Collins, which you can read on my blog on YWP. Billy Collins. I read a book of your poetry last night as the world around me grew dim. I slowly turned the pages and smiled at the windows in your words, the way they took me to a room with vases of flowers and to a place where all the versions of myself exist at once. I saw bits of myself in every stanza and every metaphor that draws you in, then carefully sets you back next to a bowl of pears. I saw my strong self and my fragile self in your poetry. I saw the part of me that aches to write everything, to somehow capture all the words that are alive, to feel the solid weight of them in my hand. Sometimes when I'm writing, I feel desperate, like I'm not moving fast enough, like all these phrases will drift away if I don't lift my hand out fast enough to catch them. It's like walking in reverse or falling down Alice's rabbit hole. The unbreakable darkness that surrounds me, unforgiving but not unkind. The only way to let poetry fall from my body, to let it escape and wave goodbye, to let it calmly watch as I imagine throwing my typewriter against the wall, destructive but not monstrous. In your words, I saw my desperation, and I saw how badly I want to write how you write, looking out a window with a cup of coffee, watching as the world walks by. I really love that poem that I just read to you. That's my poem. I really like it because I think that it's so cool how I was so suddenly struck by inspiration when I read Billy Collins's poetry, and then I really wanted to write something that captured how much I loved it and how much it meant to me, and I wrote this, and I really like how it came out, and yeah. So now, switching to books, I love so many. It would take me months and months to list them all, and why I love them, but I'll just name a few. One of my all-time favorites that has really stuck with me, and again, it's the same thing with books, where if a line or chapter or scene sticks with me and has a lasting effect, then I like it. And I love The Fault in Our Stars by John Green. The love story and the tragedy mixed with the comedy. It's a really amazing story, and I cry every single time at the ending. And I love how John Green's characters are so human in the sense that they have flaws, but they're lovable. You know, we know that they're not perfect, but we still love them so much. And I also really like Genuine Fraud by E. Lockhart, which tells the story from the end to the beginning, so backwards. And when I first read this, I thought it was so genius, and it really inspired me to play around with the order of events in my stories and like adding in flashbacks and, you know, memories from earlier than the current time setting. Also, her book, We Were Liars, which is so amazing and has so many amazing metaphors, and this is another one that really stuck out to me, and I remember it still now. I read this book years ago, but this is from the first page or second page, the very beginning, and the narrator says that her father pulled out a handgun and shot me in the chest. I was standing on the lawn and I fell. The bullet hole opened wide and my heart rolled out of my ribcage and down into a flower bed. Blood gushed rhythmically from my open wound, then from my eyes, my ears, my mouth. It tasted like salt and failure. The bright red shame of being unloved soaked the grass in front of our house, the bricks of the path, the steps of the porch. My heart spasmed among the peonies like a trout. At the time, I was so shocked by this, and I thought it was real, and then I realized it was a metaphor, and a really amazingly vivid one. And I think that this is the kind of writing that really sticks with me, because it's so descriptive and vivid, yet it's just capturing the narrator's emotions, you know? This isn't like a real scene where her father actually shot her, but like this is how the narrator felt, and I feel like it's just so much better than just saying like, oh, I was really sad, I was really angry, I felt like I was betrayed, you know? Those descriptions are a little cheap to me, whereas this really stands out because it's so unique, and you know, I've never heard, you know, this feeling described like this before. And I think that's another thing about writing that sticks out to me is when I read something that describes a feeling or emotion in a way that I've never heard before. So like a completely fresh and original take on anger or sadness, you know, because it's so easy when you're writing to just say, I was mad, I was angry, I was so sad, you know, but finding new ways to express that, like saying, you know, like comparing it to actually being shot in the chest, because that's how heavy it felt to you, that's how intense it was in the moment. I think that's really amazing. I'm also a big fan of The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak, because it's another one that I return to again and again. And a big part of why I love this book is the narrator, who's death himself. And I love how this allows the story to open up to show the effects of World War II, because it takes place during that time. It shows the effects of the war outside of just Liesl's life. She's like one of the main characters. The writing in here is also so amazing, and the characters are, again, human and flawed, but they're lovable. And we love them not despite their mistakes, but because of them. We love them because they're relatable, you know? They're not put on such a high pedestal where, like, we don't know how we can relate our lives to theirs. They're human and real, and they seem like actual people. That's another one that I cried at the end of. Oh, so sad, but such a good book, really. And I think that inspired me, too, to kind of not stick to the same narration, you know? To feel like I can kind of explore and play around with how I want to tell my story. Do I want to tell it from a different perspective? Do I want to tell it third person, first person, you know? How do I want to tell my story instead of just writing it how I would normally write it? And I am a huge fan of Agatha Christie. I've read a lot of her books.
Actually, I was completely wrong. It's Deus Ex Machina. What stands out to me in her
books is how the ending is always unique. It's never the same in each book, but it isn't far-fetched, you know? It isn't like, there's this thing called, in story writing, called, I'm gonna find it, Deus Ex Machina, I hope I said that right, which is basically used in tragedy writing back in old time, or actually used now. It's loosely translated as God from the Machine, where you can resolve complicated or hopeless situations in very kind of far-fetched ways, where there's an artificial or kind of made-up solution to an insolvable problem, which, you know, isn't very good writing in my opinion. But anyway, Agatha Christie's endings are always, you know, they're complex, but they make sense when you think about it. And throughout the book, you're pulled from theory to theory, and it's never just like, oh yeah, I know how this is ending, I shouldn't really read the rest. I remember reading Murder on the Orient Express, the first of Agatha Christie's books that I had ever read, which was a Christmas gift from my grandma, and I immediately thought that I had figured out the ending. I knew who the murderer was, I knew it was this person and only this person, and then the ending revealed what had actually happened, and I won't spoil anything, but I was so surprised and actually really excited because I had found a mystery writer whose stories weren't cliche or kind of expected, you know? You can't really anticipate how it's going to end because there are so many red herrings and just complexities. And I really, really love Crooked House. That's one of my favorite Agatha Christie books. And the complexity of the characters and the shocking ending is what sticks with me. And actually, I remember reading about Agatha Christie because I wrote about her life and her work for my final project for my 8th grade English class. But anyway, I remember reading that at first when she sent the manuscript for Crooked House to her publishers, they refused to publish it because they said that the ending was too shocking and her readers wouldn't like it. It was too shocking for like the 30s or 40s when I think it came out. But she insisted that that was how it was going to end and she didn't want to change it. That's how the story was. And so they published it. And it is shocking, but it's amazing. And I think it's amazing because it's shocking. You know, if she had changed the ending and made it more like reader friendly as the publishers had wanted her to, then I don't think it would have the lasting effect that it has now. So, speaking of mystery writers, I also love Tana French. And I recently discovered her Dublin Murder Squad series, and I really, really like it. And I think that her writing is similar to Agatha Christie's in the sense that I think I have it all figured out, but in reality I was completely wrong, and it ends up being a simple crime, but I had made it too simple. And her characters are also so psychologically complex, and I really like how she takes on such a strong psychological perspective, and The Witch Elm is one of her standalone books, and it's so good. All of them are just so good, and her writing has definitely inspired me in my own writing of both poetry and fiction and mysteries and just writing about characters and really, like, developing them as real people. Yeah, I think that that's another thing that stands out to me. So these are the, like, to sum it up, this is what really stands out to me when I read writing is a lasting effect and relatable characters. Characters that are very well developed, that feel like real people who you could call up on the phone and you could talk to. Or people who don't seem so two-dimensional. Like, there are more dimensions to them. They're complex. They have all these childhood memories that have, you know, affected them as adults and as teenagers. And, you know, they've had struggles and successes, and there's a lot to them. I think that those characters really stick with me and make me like a book and make me return to it again and again. There are so many characters like that that I think have made a lot of books successful. Like, if you think about classic books like The Wizard of Oz and A Wrinkle in Time and Dr. Dolittle and books like that, you know, from our childhoods, and Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer and all those books, it's because of the characters that seem real, you know? They seem like they could be your best friend. And also, I loved all of those books when I was younger. The Wizard of Oz was so cool to me that, you know, they were on the same planet, but they were going through so many different worlds. It was just so amazing to me. And just this story of, like, going to the Emerald City and the lion who needs courage and the Tin Man who wants a heart and Dorothy who just wants to go home, and it's just, I love that story so much. What else did I just mention? Dr. Dolittle. I've talked about this so many times, but that was my favorite book when I was growing up. My dad and I read it over and over and over again, and I really loved it. I wanted to be a naturalist, actually, like Dr. Dolittle, because at the time, I thought that was, like, the coolest thing ever, because, of course, if you were a naturalist, you could therefore talk to animals, and I wanted to talk to animals, so it was really amazing. I love that book, and the writing, too, was really good, and I've said this so many times, but that scene where Dr. Dolittle is writing in the giant snail shell on the ocean floor, and they're just crawling along super slowly, and he's just writing away, that was so amazing to me to think that, like, you could, a character or a person, you know, because as you read a book, you kind of imagine yourself in the place of the character. That's the magic of reading, really, is imagining yourself in all these different worlds. But I imagine myself, like, sitting in the shell of a giant snail, crawling along the ocean floor, writing poetry or just whatever I wanted. And it was a really amazing scene to me. And that's definitely stuck with me, even, like, 10 years after first reading it, like, it's still engraved in me. As a writer and as a human being. And yeah. Lastly, I wanted to end with a piece of my own writing. And I think that as much inspiration as I find in other writing, I find within my own life and my own writing. And this is a little, almost poem, sort of essay that I wrote during my time in the Governor's Institute of the Arts this past summer, which was an amazing program. It was in response to the prompt, "Why do you write?" And I think it's a great reminder to myself when I get down about not feeling like my writing is good enough or feeling like, what's the point to write? Why am I even doing this, you know? If no one's going to read this, if I'm just doing this for myself, why do I write? Here it is. Enjoy. And thank you very much for listening to part 2 of the 20th episode of Flying Break. I write to bring the words in my head to life. I create stories and poems and series of sentences that have bloomed in my mind. Sprouted from bits of inspiration, gold flickers amongst the grassy terrain. I write to piano and forte my thoughts onto paper. Ink spills are pools of disbelief and awe. I write to allow myself the power to be limitless. No boxes, no grades, no chains tied around my fingertips. Words are flimsy, but they are warm and keep me comforted. I write to create bonfires of acceptance, accepting myself as human and therefore flawed, accepting others as beyond my control, and accepting the world as a place where teapots pour out kaleidoscopes of greed and love, both tinted with rose and brushed with brass. Tarnished but lovely, they fall effortlessly from our mugs to the napkins, staining the thin paper with little splotches of color. I write because it feels like the only thing that is true. When I get stuck in reality, unable to escape, I let the words tumble from me, light a match, and watch everything spark on fire. Only I see this explosion, but that makes it more special to know that my eyes are the only eyes in the world who have witnessed this sight. I write to love. This has been part 2 of episode 20 of Line Break with just me, Eyes of Iris. I hope you enjoyed, and stay tuned for the very, very special Anthology 11 edition of Line Break coming to you September 19th. Bye!